I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Actor Wendell Pierce and his family were Katrina refugees forced to flee New Orleans when that storm flooded the city 10 years ago. They returned to Pontchartrain Park, where his parents had lived for half a century, to a scene of utter devastation. A few years later, Wendell Pierce performed in Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot in two neighborhoods hardest hit by Katrina, a turning point for him. He has a home now in New Orleans, rebuilt his parents' home, and is one of the residents determined to restore their city and preserve its vibrant culture. I first saw Wendell Pierce when he played Detective Bunk Moreland in The Wire and later as trombonist Antoine Baptiste in Tremé, two groundbreaking programs on HBO. They were remarkable performances. Wendell Pierce writes about all of this in his memoir. It's called The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you
on
for
Radio
having me.
Times. I would actually love to have you read a section from the book that I pulled out, which is you and your parents are coming home. I think you flipped the page.
Yes.
There you go. You and your parents are coming home for the first time to see what had happened to your community, to your neighborhood.
The only image I can compare post apocalyptic Pontchartrain Park to is Hiroshima after the atomic bomb. The devastation was so complete, so definitive. We stopped at a Red Cross station on the perimeter before going in and got food, drink, and supplies, including hazmat suits, because the water that flooded the area had been so toxic. Making our way over to our beloved DeBoer Drive was like homecoming in Chernobyl. Everything was gray from caked-on mud left behind by weeks of stagnant water. There was so much debris in the streets that we had to drive on sidewalks. The silence was absolute. Not a soul around. All the trees were destroyed. Those left standing had been stripped of their leaves. This is what I imagine nuclear winter is like. Months later, when I began rehearsing my role as Vladimir in the Classical Theater Harlem's production of Godot, which in 2007 we would reprise in New Orleans, I didn't have to work to place myself in the desolation imagined by Beckett. I had been there with my family. I had seen it, smelled it, felt its wrath, and absorbed its numbing lessons amid a silence that seemed eternal. At last we pulled up to our house. The grass was gone, and mud was caked above the doors. But it was still standing. There were no cars. There were no people. If there was movement, even two blocks away, you could hear it. The stench of mold, chemicals, mud, sewage, stagnant water, and decay was overwhelming. As silly as it sounds, we tried to open the front door with a key, which didn't work. So Ron and I broke down the door.
That's our guest, Wendell Pierce, reading from his memoir, The Wind in the Reeds. You also say that, and you were with your parents, your family, everyone cried. And your dad said, I don't want to come back.
Yeah.
It's he too said, much.
Yeah, he was so in pain. It was like losing a member of the family. You have to imagine a black man coming back from World War II to the segregated South, to New Orleans, and having an opportunity to buy a home with the GI Bill, with this movement that had created this mecca, this Pontchartrain Park. It came out of the civil rights movement. You know, a black person could only go to the park on one day out of the week. Wednesday is Negro Day. Open air space.
You
weren't allowed in New Orleans during segregation. And so the advocacy against that in the civil rights movement, led by A.P. Turow, led to Pontchartrain Park. It was separate but equal. It wasn't the complete solution, but we took something ugly and made it beautiful, and it became an incubator for great talent, you know, in the African-American community. And so this was a place of great pride and a special place that my father talks about to this day of when he put down $10 to hold the contract. And so it was another death in the family. We had lost my older brother, you know, in 2000, and here 5 years later, we lost the home. And he said, this is where we raised our kids. And I remember him, you know, turning to my mother and said, it's all gone.
you did rebuild their house.
Yes.
So he lives essentially in the same
location. Yes, he lives. I gave myself a mission. I said, I want to make sure to get my parents back home before they die. They had worked too hard. They had sacrificed so much for that little house. And I said that to myself, that was a mission, and I achieved that. And that was something that I hold dear. At the same time, then members of the community said, Wendell, you were able to get your family back, but we need the attention. You know, as my parents taught me, there are those who don't have your best interest at heart. So you have to be ever vigilant. And that was happening in New Orleans, you know. People saw the disaster and was going to take advantage of it, and did take advantage of it, and still taking advantage of it. And I knew that we were in the crosshairs, my community, because it was of where it's located, a golf course right in the middle. And, that golf course is historic, you know, designed by Joseph Bartholomew, who designed most of the courses in New Orleans but couldn't play on them in segregation because he was African-American. His own courses, he used to walk them at night so no white folks would see him walking the golf course because he could get arrested. So I wanted to make sure that we owed it to them to come back.
Well, part of the subtitle is about a play. This is Waiting for Godot. And, gosh, you know, if you think about it, what a perfect play in a sort of perverse kind of way. What a perfect
the resonance,
play to put on in New Orleans a couple years after Katrina.
Yes, the resonance of Waiting for Godot, a play about desolation, a play about depression, about losing spirit and hopelessness in this void of nothingness, just two men who don't remember their past, don't have any hope for the future, and are waiting for something outside of themselves, this entity of Godot, to come and actually give meaning and purpose and focus to their existence. But it's complete and absolute human desolation. And that's the thing that speaks to people across generations, across time and place, and makes it a classic play. From when Beckett wrote it under Nazi occupation in Paris, it spoke to the people of Sarajevo when Susan Sontag did it in the 80s. And it was so resonant for the people of New Orleans. And I brought the play home to the Lower Ninth Ward. And I'll remember coming from two blocks away making my entrance.
Was it an open lot where you were playing?
We're talking about an entire neighborhood. We're talking about you can stand on that corner where we did it and look for a mile one way or the other and see nothing but destruction, a complete destruction, 360. And people from all parts of the city came to the play. And it was just a moment of clarity and awakening and epiphany, like it happens in the play, where you say, at this place, in this moment of time, all mankind is us. Let us do something while we have the chance before it's too late. It's an awakening for the characters in the play, but it was an epiphany and awakening for me, too, to the power of art, the transformative nature of art, the revelatory nature of art. And it was a moment where I stepped out of character and really, in a communal sense of all the people there from New Orleans, we knew that this is something that we had to do for ourselves.
In fact, you write in this book that this play, performing in this play, breathed life into your bones. I mean, you clearly had been an actor well before this, but was it this play in this neighborhood at that time, Waiting for Godot?
Absolutely. And that's what real catharsis is. It made me remember the power of art and why I became an artist and understand that there was a great legacy that had been passed on to me. We live our culture in New Orleans. Our culture is insurrection, is rebellion. You know, you see a second line. Associated and pleasure clubs have second lines. But what people don't understand, they understand the pleasure part.
Right.
You see a good time, a party, let's go down the street and parade. But don't forget that first part of social aid. Poor black folks who weren't allowed to get burial plots were redlined out of insurance policies, were denied all kinds of opportunities because of this ugly time of Jim Crow segregation, pooled their money into social aid and pleasure clubs and made benevolent associations. So, Marty, if your mother takes sick, we'll take care of you and her. If your daddy dies, we're going to send him off in this beautiful jazz funeral in celebration of his life and take care of you. And then second lines happen seasonally every Sunday, 3 o'clock, right on the dot in different parts of New Orleans. different social aid and pleasure clubs have their particular Sunday. Everybody knows, and they compete with each other and all. But they literally are walking commerce into their community. This cultural act of beauty and pageantry and music is it's a walking economic engine into underserved communities. So I tell people, when you go to the second line, don't just look at the parade ahead and dance with it. Look behind. There's the woman selling water. There's the guy selling barbecue. And you go from one restaurant to a member's house to a different club member's place of business. And people are literally parading into hunger and thirst and building an economic engine. That's the benevolence of it. Yeah.
One thing that I've heard, I'm sure you have as well, and because you live some time in New Orleans, that it's a whiter city than it was, and, mm-hmm. and that a number of African Americans who were forced out haven't been able to come back. Mm-hmm. Does that worry you?
It more than worries me. It actually it angers me. You have to understand, this happened on August 29th, the flooding of New Orleans, Katrina. On September 8th, Jimmy Reese, I like to say his name, a business elite of New Orleans, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal said, this is the best thing ever happened. We'll be able to get rid of the people we don't want. We'll be able to change this city demographically, geographically, and politically. And if they don't, and if it doesn't change, we're not coming back. We, this business elite.
He's a businessman.
Yeah, business elite. He's actually on the commission, the Bring Back New Orleans Commission, appointed on that commission by the mayor, and their plan was to then let communities just go away. The Green Dot program, and on the front page of the Times-Picayune, a big green dot was placed on all of these neighborhoods that they said we're going to just let go back to green space. And that,
like the Ninth Ward.
Like the Ninth Ward, my neighborhood. Can you imagine waking up and seeing a map on the front page of the newspaper with a big green dot on your neighborhood saying, we're just going to let this neighborhood go away? They had no desire to let the neighborhood go away. In the 21st century, we're just going to allow it to be taken back, reclaimed by nature? No. It was a plan to displace people. And they have succeeded in the plan of displacing people, because we're talking about 100,000 people, almost a third of the city that was there before, displaced. What he doesn't realize is the very people that he got rid of, that those people that they were focusing this attack, this war on the poor, are the very people that created the culture that we're known for around the world. You know, it is the gale force winds that we had to deal with after the gale force winds that destroyed our city. You know, but that's what the resilience is all about. You know, and the fact that it's Sidney Bechet. And Louis Armstrong, they came from the very communities that he wants to get rid of.
That's Wendell Pierce, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, a well-known actor. He's also written a memoir. It's called The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and the City That Would Not Be Broken. We are talking about New Orleans. We'll be talking about some of his roles and performances. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Wendell Pierce. You probably know him from his work in The Wire, also in Tremé, a number of other television programs and movies as well. And again, he's got a new memoir called The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. What is Pontchartrain Park? What does it look like today? This is where you grew up. This is where your mom and dad bought their first house.
Yes. It is on the rebound. We're not fully back the way, you know, we envision it. But, the awakening that I tried to describe in this memoir, you know, the snapshot of a time, was about remembering how Pontchartrain Park came about, you know. You had this advocacy to build it. This Moses generation gave us, this Joshua generation, this great place. It was like a black Mayberry. It was an incubator of great talent, and it made you realize that it was worth saving. So we put together our own community development corporation and started redeveloping it ourselves. To date, we've done almost 40 houses. Brick by brick, house by house, block by block, we're pretty much back. We've advocated to make sure that the golf course was redone and is brought back. Southern University of New Orleans is back, a historic black college, multi-denominational churches, and even Major League Baseball recognized what we were doing. And so they actually came and redid Wesley Barrow Stadium, a small stadium that's right in the neighborhood where I did my little league and football and all. And it's an urban youth academy, one of only three places where Major League Baseball comes in and trains the kids. They have about 400 kids there. And so we have advocated to make sure that this neighborhood comes back, because it was given to us through great sacrifice and great advocacy of people working long and hard to make sure it existed in the first place.
Well, you describe a kind of, as you said, kind of a Black Mayberry, but you do describe a pretty idyllic childhood. You could play outside.
Great, yeah.
And you also said that as a kid, and you're one of three brothers, that you were loved. I mean, it was clear that you were loved. And there were people looking out for other people as well.
You know, people recognize this. And it's not unique just to my neighborhood, but we have mothers and fathers all around the community that took care of you. You felt safe, especially in the time when it was threatened. Gentilly Woods was next to us. It was a neighborhood that was not too friendly to us, because it was still segregated times. Segregation had ended by the time I was a child, but the segregation of the mind and spirit was still there. So, but it was a place where the parents took care of you, and you felt loved, and more importantly, it was expected of you to do whatever you could. And that was the sort of thing that I realized came from the legacy of my family, that this resilience we needed to rebuild New Orleans, this awakening that I had with the art, showed me that culturally, that intersection between life and people itself, we live our culture more than any other place that I'm familiar with. We live our culture in New Orleans, and our culture has always been about that resilience, and it's always been a part of my family, too. And I recognized in all the lessons that my mother and father and my grandparents were teaching me was this legacy that was being passed on. So a part of my awakening was to remember and realize that I'm a part of something larger and eternal. You know, something spiritual, even. And a part of that lesson was, there are those that do not have your best interest at heart. And then also, my grandfather had a mantra, which was, can't die 3 days before the creation of the world. Don't ever tell me you can't do something.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Powerful
and so
words,
that was
yeah.
powerful words. So it wasn't if I was going to go to college. It's, you know, what college are you going to? My niece, fifth generation, is here, you know, in Philadelphia at Drexel. And so she continues on that legacy. And that was expected in Pontchartrain Park. The first black mayor came from there. Mark Morial, the National Urban League president and also former mayor of New Orleans. Lisa Jackson, I grew up with her, the former EPA director.
Right.
Terrence Blanchard, the jazz Grammy Award-winning composer and musician. It was an incubator for talent and expectation. It was an aspirational place that inspired you. And when you're dealing with that, you realize that's the power of culture. That's the power of art, that intersection between life and people. It's the forum where you reflect on who you are, declare your values, and then act on them. And that was always a part of the culture that I grew up with in New Orleans, the social aid and pleasure clubs. The creation of jazz itself captured Africans, allowed to play the bambula and dance on Sundays. Hearing that, and hearing the brass music of their captors, and combining it to jazz, one of the greatest expressions of the American aesthetic. Although I am confined, captured, my aspirational freedom is expressed in the creation of the art, which leads to aspirational freedom, physical freedom that ultimately I'm going to get to. It was the incubator of that insurrection where they went away and fought for generations to get to that place of freedom. It was there in Congo Square where the creation of this American aesthetic of jazz, where other people, free people of color who had come from Haiti, created the seeds of the modern social justice movement, of the civil rights movement. You know, Paul Levine and Homer Plessy, that we're all familiar with, Plessy versus Ferguson, right there in Treme, right on the grounds of Congo Square. So it was an artistic and activism and incubator for activism also. The two are combined. And that was the tradition of New Orleans culture and art. It was revelatory.
Did you play an instrument? I mean, clearly you became an actor, but did you play an instrument as a kid growing
every
up?
Every little boy in New
Trombone
Orleans.
Trombone by any chance?
Every little boy in New Orleans grabs a trumpet first,
okay,
right? Because, you
fair,
know,
yes.
You look cooler, I guess, if you play trumpet. And I actually had to turn my trumpet back in because I was so bad.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't practice. So it was really, Mr. Lewis said, Mr. Pierce, play that one line. And I said, which one? And I tried to play it. And he's like, you haven't practiced. Turn your horn back in. But I learned to play trombone for the show of Treme.
Well, and I have to ask you about that, and I can't tell you how many people came up to me knowing that I was going to interview you saying, how did Wendell Pierce fake playing that trombone because it looked so real?
Well, I learned every tune. I learned every solo.
So you knew the finger.
I knew, yeah, the positions of the slide. And just off camera was Stafford Agee from the Rebirth Brass Band, and they actually recorded him. But we mirrored each other.
So you could see him?
I could see him. He could see me. And, I made sure that my slide was in position. They made sure they didn't put a mic on my horn because I sounded like a fifth grader. And he sounds like the world-class jazz musician that he is. But, I mean, to this day, it was, 3 years ago, I still remember my first solo. You know, so
did you get better? I mean, as
I got better. I actually, some nights I tried to sit in with Rebirth, got up on the stage at the Maple Leaf Bar where they play every Tuesday night and tried to play with
them. How'd you do?
I was awful. Sometimes I was good. You know, what happens is I got a little liquid courage in me, and then that became the joke. Get him to play because, he thinks he sounds good, but sometimes I hung in there.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Wendell Pierce, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, an actor, an activist, I should add as well, and also an author, the author of a book called, it's a memoir called The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm of Play in the City That Would Not Be Broken. I can see a lot of people want to join the conversation. Let me give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Just a couple more questions about growing up in New Orleans. You talk about going to the New Orleans Symphony, hearing Peter and the Wolf. I mean, that you were just sort of like bathed, I guess, in this culture. How could you not? I don't know.
It was so important. Growing up, it was an annual thing. And it was three events a year that we were able to go to. It usually was a traveling troupe of a play. There was definitely going to be some jazz, because we had so many great jazz musicians around. And then we would go to the symphony.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but all symphonies believe that kids only can deal with Peter and the Wolf.
It's
a great little piece of music. Yeah. And I loved it because it just I knew what to expect. And, I was learning the song and all. But it really just cultivated a love of culture in me and realized that a sense of expression, a sense of individuality, a sense of purpose, a sense that you have something to say, a sense of creativity, a sense of improvisation, to have the flexibility to change. And just like school is a gym for your intellectual muscle, that's what the artistic muscle needs. And we have forgotten that in America. We think of our art and our culture as just entertainment. And entertainment is a residual of art. It is the forum in which you reflect on who you are, what thoughts are to the individual. That's what art is to the community as a whole, where you reflect on who you are and who you hope to be. And that's where we declare our values and then act on them. And it was that sort of connection to culture was something that was an annual, a daily, weekly event for me. And living in New Orleans, because we live our culture, we sing when we talk, hey, Marty, hey, baby, how you doing, baby? And then I went to NOCA, which is the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, my performing arts high school. And Bob Elliott and Nelson were my mentors, and I'm looking forward to actually seeing them tonight. Two of my mentors, Bob Nelson, who's here, Bob Cronin, who's here in Philadelphia, and Nelson Camp, who's was in the Philadelphia area. He's in New Jersey now, and I'm going to see them tonight for the first time for years, and it's going to be a wonderful reunion. We've lost Elliot years ago, but they were the men who also gave me that seed and fire to go right. on and be the actor that I wanted to be.
Well, you went on to Juilliard to study there, and I do want to actually play a clip from The Wire, but there's something you write in the book that I thought so interesting, and you said so critical to performance, and you call it shedding.
Oh, shedding. Well,
shedding.
Every jazz musician knows that's getting in the woodshed and practicing for hours and making sure you're a student of your craft. Mm-hmm. So, because if you're a student of your craft, then you realize that you can really explore it. It's the idea of being an artist is knowing that there's a finite amount of letters with an infinite amount of possibility of combinations. It's like the jazz musician who understands that there's a finite amount of notes but an infinite amount of combinations. There's an infinite amount of expressions for the actor to ply your craft and put your imprint in that, like a seal of wax on a piece of wood or painting that'll last for generations over time that a visual artist has. That comes from shedding. Understanding, being a student of your craft, understanding the technical proficiency of your craft, and that gives you the freedom to be unlimited in your expression of your craft.
Let me play
And that's shedding.
Let me play a scene from HBO's The Wire. This is our guest, Wendell Pierce. He's Detective Bunk Moreland. He's chastising Omar, who makes his living robbing and murdering drug dealers in Baltimore.
I was a few years ahead of you at Edmondson, but I know you remember the neighborhood, how it was. We had some bad boys for real. It wasn't about guns so much as knowing what to do with your hands. Those boys could really rack. My father had me on the straight. But like any young man, I wanted to be hard too. So I would turn up at all the house parties where the tough boys hung. They knew I wasn't one of them. Them hard cases would come up to me and say, "Go home, schoolboy, you don't belong here." Didn't realize at the time what they were doing for me. As rough as that neighborhood could be, we had us a community. Nobody, no victim who didn't matter. And now all we got is bodies and predatory mother like you. And out where that girl fell, I saw kids acting like Omar, calling you by name, glorifying your ass. Makes me sick, mother, how far we done fell.
And that's a scene from The Wire featuring our guest, Wendell Pierce. He played Detective Bunk Moreland. And, you know, listening to that, not seeing it, obviously we're just listening to it, the pacing of your voice, the breathing, even just the tone of your voice is just so powerful.
Thank you. It really was just a display of what I studied. Most of the black men and women who become police officers were inspired to become police officers because the small percentage, maybe that 1% of the criminal element, did not define the neighborhoods that they grew up in. The neighborhoods they grew up in with men and women and families who got up every morning and went out to do and live better and provide for their families. And they become police officers because they those are the people that they wanted to protect. And Omar is a part of the community, too. He's that 1%. And that was just real demonstration of how there was a time in community where, because of the denied opportunities of education and upward mobility and all, that even the criminal element knew how important it was. There was a story that the father of my girlfriend at the time told me because he was in Oklahoma, and he would go to these parties, and if the thugs saw him, they called him schoolboy. They didn't know schoolboy. You don't belong here.
Wow.
Because we know that you're going somewhere. You know, he's a retired doctor now. They knew that that opportunity was too rare, especially for black folks, you know, in the ugly times of this country. So they said, we're going to protect you. They had a sense of community and responsibility then. And that's what he's trying to impress upon Omar in that moment. It is that balance and understanding that we should go back to as we reflect on what's happening in Baltimore's particular, this summer, this uprising. And it just shows you, that's why I'm so proud of the work we did with The Wire. It is a piece of art. It is the forum that people now can reflect on all of those seasons about all the dysfunctions in our urban communities, in our cities, and see how can I change the paradigm. Let's have a reflection on what is not working, find what can work, and let's apply it. That is why at universities all around this country, they study The Wire. That is what art is supposed to do, spurn that debate and actually get people to start to think about how to change it. That's the role of art. And that's what The Wire does to the discussion of the decay of the American empire. That's what Tremé did as group therapy for people who had gone through this great trauma. They used to look at Tremé and reflect on how far they've come, right. and not lose a hope and not give in to despair. Reflect on that. We've made some progress. And that's why I'm very proud of that scene from The Wire. Because I know that that scene can be at the heart of the discussion of what the Baltimore uprising was all about and if we're going to change things so it doesn't happen again.
And that's Wendell Pierce, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his acting career. He also has a new book, a memoir called The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm of Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. I'm hogging our guest. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Wendell Pierce. He has a new book called The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm of Play in the City That Would Not Be Broken. We've been talking about his life growing up in New Orleans. He has a home there now. He's also a very busy actor as well. Let me get Clark, who's been waiting very patiently from Kennett Square, to join us on Radio Times. And Clark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Wendell, it's just such a great thing to be able to talk to you. I so admire your work. And the test to me of like any good actor is whether you can believe that he is anybody other than the role that he's playing. And I got to say, with Bunk and with your role in Tremé, I could not believe you were anybody else but those characters.
Thank you, Clark. Really greatly appreciate that.
I'm curious if you have anything to say about one scene in The Wire that you did with Dominic West, and you guys only used one word. It looked like the best scene that actors ever got to do. It looked like a tremendous amount of fun.
It was
one of my favorite scenes.
Well, that's great, Clark. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Clark. The scene he's referring to is in the first season where we only used the F word.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget when David Simon came to us and said, I'm writing this scene. You're going to come to a crime scene. You realize that the guy who did it before didn't do a good job. It doesn't kind of add up, and you realize that the shooting couldn't have happened inside, and you're going to discover that it had to be outside, and then you're going to discover a piece of evidence. We said, okay. And he said, but you're only going to be able to use that word, one word, or some semblance of it. And it was a great scene to do. It was difficult to do, but it was the greatest example of what acting is about, which is you play the moments – and you play the thoughts, and the words are induced by that. And so it's a great acting exercise to only use one word, but understand that you understood every beat of the scene. And it's one of my favorites. That and the Omar scene are my two favorite scenes in all the years of The Wire that I did.
You wrote about getting this part in The Wire, and you actually had a little altercation in New York. You got yourself arrested after having a fist fight with the cab driver, and you were so angry. I guess it sounds like you just sort of vented.
I came into the audition venting, and I just said, I can't believe that, what happened to me, and this guy didn't want to take me, and I just vented about, you know, I get out of the cab, I'm not going to pay him, he takes a swing at me, we get in a fight, the police pass by, and they arrest me. Oh, so I was mad, and I went off. Cut to,
yeah,
weeks later, months later, actually, working on The Wire, sitting around waiting for a setup, and David said, you know, when you came in for the audition, and you told that story about getting arrested, I said, oh, yeah, yeah. He said, that was bunk. And that's when you got the part. None of your reading. You know, when you told that story, we realized, oh, yeah, that's bunk.
Was there a real bunk in Baltimore? I mean, someone that you did actually.
I actually worked with. He is a dear friend, Oscar Requeir. He is the bunk. And he came to see me work. I worked with him, you know, and, you know, kind of prepared and did research with him. And he came the first day I was shooting. Pulled up in his Cadillac, had a cigar, and he was in the distance, and he looked at me so strange with his face wrinkled up going, what? And it was like, what is this boy doing, right? And I was so afraid of his opinion of my work and me portraying this fictionalized bunk that I didn't talk to him for 5 years.
Wow.
I never talked to him. And one day someone said, you know he's retiring, and you better be there. And I went to the retirement party. I said, oh, yes, I'm going to be there. I went there, and I walked in. I could see him across the room looking at me quizzically. And then all of a sudden, he said, hey, Bunk, you made me famous. Come here. And it was like the prodigal son coming home. And we've been dear friends ever since. And I owe him a call.
And he was called Bunk, sort of like a bunk mate kind of thing?
Yeah, he would call people Bunk, you know, and everybody knew the Bunk because he was like, hey, Bunk, an old army term. Your bunk mate, your guy you're rooming with, you know.
Let me play a scene from Treme. This is season 3. Our guest, Wendell Pierce, a jazz musician, Antoine Baptiste. He's discussing his love of the jazz band leader, Papa Celestin, and his version of the song Marie Laveau with a young student named Jennifer.
I love it when the band comes in on the vocal. I used to do that a lot in the old days. Papa and Fats Waller. Yeah. Always cracks me up.
Call and response?
Yeah, that's right. The lead sings, oh, Marie Laveau. Then the guys in the band go, Marie Laveau. Yes, Marie Laveau. You sing,
Marie Laveau.
Folks still believe in the voodoo queen.
It's a
great scene.
It brings back memories. It brings back great memories.
Yeah.
It also is it's demonstration how the connection of legacy, you know, of Papa Celeste going all the way back then, and here's this young girl that Antoine is teaching. It's the legacy of the music that has been passed on from those Africans who created it, you know, generations later, something that connects you to the past and it makes you present. What makes it classic is the fact that it will speak to human beings long after we're gone. It was created with such authenticity that it spoke to people long before we arrived, and we feel it, and we're going to pass it on. And that actress is Jasmine.
I was going to say, who is that actress?
Cause she actually is a great trumpet player in New Orleans right now, playing with the Pinnettes Jazz Band. She actually was playing in the show. Those are real musicians. The trombone player, that kid who's in the band, Jeffrey Miller, plays at Juilliard and actually plays with John Batiste, who was from the Batiste family that I was named after, who's on the Stephen Colbert show, who went to NOCA. So that long legacy and connection shows you the power that people are given with art and the legacy that is there. And it also was just reflective of what we are fighting for to rebuild in New Orleans, the northernmost Caribbean city, that last bohemia, the city that cared for God, the Big Easy, New Orleans.
Well, interestingly, and I loved watching Antoine Baptiste sort of get seduced by these kids. I mean, he falls in love with them and he cares about them. He's tough with them. And I know your mom was a teacher.
Yes, my mother was a teacher, and that was really a tribute to her. And what Tremé was for me was beyond a television show. While it was therapeutic for everyone as we reflected on what we were going through, and that's what its role was as a piece of art. It was also a godsend for me. The last years I got to spend with my mother and honor her in tribute of being a teacher, because she was a teacher for like 40 years.
What'd she teach?
She taught first grade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I was known for years as Mrs. Pierce's son in my neighborhood. And to come home and see her friends who were my teachers at the school going, "Oh, Pierce, he has homework. Don't let him get away with anything." It was she was a blessed woman and really gave me the spirit of the desire to do whatever I desired to do.
You write in your book, her death was without a doubt the most profound experience you've ever gone through.
Absolutely. Like I said, Tremé brought me home in a way. It was divine intervention. I got to spend the last years and last moments with my mother. I held her in my arms and put her to bed as she took her last breath and said, "That was a good one."
Wow.
Her last words to me,
that was a good one.
And it was about the fact that I was finally just able to just hold her and comfort. I hope I gave her comfort in the final moments of her life as much as she gave me comfort. I would spend so much time just rubbing her back, because I remember
she used to rub your back
as a child, how she would rub my back. Mm. And that brought me such comfort. I think about a mother's touch to this day. And she was a woman of great faith and challenged my faith. I was thinking about her last week as the Pope visited her. I did a pilgrimage for my 50th birthday, trying to reconnect with my mother. I went to Fatima in Portugal.
Oh.
And as a pilgrim was there, my mother asked that I try to reconnect going to church and reconnect with my spirituality. And I'm the first to say that I'm challenged with that. And in that moment, I realized that I was grieving her. I really went there hoping to find her. And as I looked up, as they were having the procession of the Blessed Mother going back to her place of honor, all the pilgrims raised their handkerchiefs up. And all of a sudden, thousands of miles away, I was right back at a second line.
Wow.
The way we honor our death and honor our loved ones at home. And that's when I really finally said goodbye to my mother.
Mm. Your dad's still alive, right?
My dad is still alive. I just saw him this
weekend.
In his
90s, right?
He's 90. He's going to be 91 in January. We celebrated his birthday this year with a big bash, and he's a huge Saints fan, and he challenged me as an artist, and he's a man who loves his country even when his country didn't love him, and a man of great character. He was disappointed that I chose to be an actor, because I had the possibility to do whatever I wanted. I was going to that great public-private school he called Ben Franklin, which was one of the best schools in the state of Louisiana, is the best school, and one of the best in the country. But he didn't deny me my pursuit of acting, because his principled belief is, if it's something you want to do, just give your heart. And he honored that. He said, "I don't want to be a part of it, but if that's something you want to do, you go on and do it. I'm not going to do it." And then on Broadway, opening night, I brought him up to New York. And I said, "Remember that time you said you're not going to bring me to any more plays or rehearsals? That's not what you were part of." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah." I said, "You remember that?" He says, "Yes." I said, "I want you to remember tonight just as much." And he says, "Son, I will, and I'm very proud of you."
Oh, nice. It's nice when sons can hear that from their dads.
And that's really just the legacy of family and what true resilience is and true character is. And that was a part of the culture of New Orleans, and seen in our resilience, in our music, in our arts and our, even our culinary arts, taking scraps from the table, putting it together with some burnt flour, building a stew that's known around the world as gumbo. A gumbo is not only something that gives you sustenance of spirit and creativity, but literal sustenance to your body, artistic sustenance to your body. We live our culture, that intersection between life and its people, our culture.
Let me get Ron from, looks like Northern Liberties, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ron. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment of adoration and a question. First, a comment. First of all, Mr. Pierce, I'm sure everyone listening to Radio Time is hanging off your every word. I've been following your career for a long time. You tell great stories. I'm not surprised that's how you got the part on The Wire. In fact, I remember a story you telling about how the insurance company didn't pay your father after the house got destroyed after Hurricane Katrina. It was a great story. But my question is, I just showed a friend of mine a clip on The Wire. It's a copy machine clip.
Yes.
And it's very funny. I watch that all the time. And I just wonder, after the director said cut, did you and the actors, you know, have to think and say, man, this is what really goes on to young people in certain communities? And as a lawyer, I know those tactics are legal. Mm-hmm. But did you have to watch yourself, you know, do you go through conversations years after saying to yourself, man, this is wrong?
Ron, yeah, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Ron. That's a great question. The back and forth in the debate of what The Wire was about, the examination of the dysfunction of our criminal justice system, absolutely, we went through that. I would always ask the police officers that I worked with, I said, you are allowed to do that? It was this one, that scene in particular reminded me of a case where they were trying to get these guys to confess, and they said, please tell me you had the Glock, not the the Glock and not the 45, because the 45 bullet killed him. Oh, yeah, I had the Glock. Write it down, confess. They go to the other guy and say, please tell me you had the 45 because the Glock gun bullet killed him. Oh, yes, and they confessed. Now, of course, it didn't matter. They both just confessed to murdering someone. And I was troubled by that, you know. And you know, I understand what you, Ron, probably have to go through as a lawyer. Continue to fight those fights to make sure that it's a balance that we have to have to constantly be vigilant about when our criminal justice system. Like I tell police officers all the time who challenge me when I say, look at police brutality and all, I said, man, the most upsetting thing about it is that police aren't upset with those who break the code of honor. That the voices we should hear from the most are police officers saying, that is not someone who should wear the badge like I do. They have lost the standard by which we honor those who are police officers. They should be the most egregious. So, yeah, we were troubled. I almost quit The Wire.
Wow.
Because I met, at the end of the fourth season, I met this wonderful little actress. I didn't have much to do with the kids. And she said, oh, Mr. Pierce, I'm going to Brown University. You're great. And I said, who do you play? She said, Zenobia. I said, the girl who slashes? Yes. And I said, we should be telling your story. And I almost quit. And then I realized we're not telling arbitrary stories. We're telling the stories of dysfunction with purpose so we can change things. And I was able to go on and be a part of The Wire.
Wendell Pierce, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And the book is called The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and the City That Would Not Be Broken. And again, our guest, actor Wendell Pierce. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. We're singing along in here. I'm Marty Moss going. Thanks for joining us.